Welcome. It's a slightly different version of the nose today. Well, no, it's the same old nose, I guess, but we're sort of in a different environs. We're down here in New Haven, which we have done a lot, but right now we're in the studios of Yale University. The reason, well, it's boring. No, it is not boring. We're building a new studio, which will be opening fairly soon in New Haven, but we don't have one right now. We gave up the old one. All right, that was boring. Let me tell you who's in the studio with me. Lucy Gelman, editor of the Arts Paper and host of WNHH Radio's Kitchen Sink, S-Y-N-C. Sean Murray, a stand-up comedian and writer and a host of the Fantasy Film Ball podcast. And Mark Oppenheimer, editor-at-large for Tablet Magazine and host of the podcast Unorthodox, among a bunch of other stuff. Also the hardest working man in journalism, publishing everywhere all the time, pretty much. Like, even while I was doing the introduction,
I published four articles this morning.
Yeah.
I got to keep my dog in milk bones, you know?
It really is kind of uncanny. I mean, I don't know how you do this. And I work really hard, too, but I look at this and I'm just... Anyway, so Dave Chappelle, talented...
He's here, too?
Yeah, he's here.
He's our fourth...
Yeah,
wow. Surprise. Good program.
Come on in,
good
Dave.
Booking. Solid booking.
Yeah, come on in, Dave. No, Dave Chappelle is a very controversial and interesting comedian and a mysterious, at times, comedian. One of the mysterious things he's done in the last 12 months is put four different one-hour comedy specials up on Netflix. We're going to talk about two of them. The two most recent ones, Equanimity and The Bird Revelation. That'll be in the second segment, though. Here in the first segment, well, the second thing we'll talk about, I do everything backwards, is an advertisement for a furniture store. Although, can you even call IKEA a furniture store
it's
anymore?
A lifestyle.
I mean, it's lifestyle something. It's like pervasive.
It's a hygge store.
It's the empire. Anyway, they've got an ad in Sweden that they want you, to urinate on. They want somebody to urinate on it anyway. And if you do... There's fabulous cash prizes. So we've just stepped into a new world of marketing. We're coming to that.
You get an R. Kelly album.
Right. But we're going to begin with a piece by Ben Yagoda, who's been a guest on the show in the past and a guy who writes about a lot of different things. And this time he's writing in Slate about what he calls the reviewer's fallacy. The notion here essentially is that critics across the board, I think Ben would say, although he harps quite a bit on books and movies, critics tend to dole out positive reviews rather than really digging in, rarely truly panning anything, that a lot of the guideposts that you might use for making consumer-oriented decisions about what you might want to consume in terms of culture are a little bit misleading because because the critics don't have the guts to tell you that some things are really bad or that a lot of things are really bad or maybe even most things are really bad. That's one of the things that's entertained in this piece. So, Lucy, you're the farthest away from me. I just want to maybe go around the table here and just see what you guys made of this particular argument.
Well, I think there were some concerns when we were talking in a group earlier that maybe this essay was a little bit cursory, and I do agree with that. But as a critic of arts and culture, who's also a consumer of arts and culture, it really rubs me the wrong way when critics are not critical and they don't do their jobs. And so I thought it was necessary to have some piece out there, and that's why. And there are kind of a lot of like meta articles about metacritical writing, maybe, but I think it was a good jumping off point to think about our critics, of whom I'm included, of whom Mark is included. Are critics doing their jobs, or are they doling out praise maybe too easily? One of the works on the essay is A Quiet Passion, the biopic about Emily Dickinson that if I, as a huge fan of Emily Dickinson, were writing about, I think would be quick to take to task because it's really not a very good work of art.
It's boring as hell, too.
Yes.
I mean, it's really, really one of the most boring movies.
But nothing about it is well done. You know, even to call it a cinematic masterpiece, like, okay, no, call Mr. Turner a cinematic masterpiece, but there's kind of no credit due in this situation. And so I think it is good to challenge the critical world and say, hey, why aren't we doing our jobs? And how are we going to do a better job of doing our jobs going forward? Or, you know, has that moment passed? And my answer to that is I really hope not, because that makes me sad as a reader.
I do want to say just quickly, when Lucy says maybe it's a little bit cursory, and I like Ben Yagoda a lot, and he's been on my show, he's a great guest. But like that particular movie that you're talking about, A Quiet Passion, which is this suffocatingly airless movie.
It's really bad.
Ben has never seen it. He's actually pointing out the fact that it's on a lot of people's top 10 lists. Both Manuela Dargis and A.O. Scott of the New York Times had it on their best 10 movies of the year list. And Ben has some other reason that comes to him from the ether for suspecting that they might be wrong. He's correct. But, like, I suffered through that damn movie, you know, and I haven't written anything about it. Why does Ben need to do that without – I mean, he should watch the movie first. Sean, what did you make of this argument?
I thought it was just kind of interesting that you have an article where people are complaining that critics are being too nice, where you usually hear the exact opposite. And I think the Quiet Passion thing was a great – the fact that he hadn't seen it is a great point because I think – a lot of the like general audiences have not seen that movie, mm-hmm. and so that's why he mentioned in the article that
he didn't see Moonlight either.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's
just a really good movie and an interesting mm-hmm. one, not yeah. a boring one.
What
at
he's
all.
Talking about is it's more of a Venn diagram between critics and audiences than it is like a circle because they have different interests. And I think like you hear a lot of critics like talk about like superhero fatigue. About like there's too many comic book movies and we're tired of them, but the audiences are the exact opposite. Like Black Panther's gonna make $1 billion in next month because people are not tired of it. So critics have different interests than general audiences. So of course you're probably gonna see. I don't know anyone who's seen A Quiet Passion until I read the article. I hadn't even heard of it.
You've just met two people. I haven't seen it either. But these two apparently
don't
felt they had $12 too much in their pocket. So.
But I don't care what's on someone else's top 10 list.
Well, let me ask you this, Sean. I mean, everybody, for good or ill, and I think a lot for ill, we all use Rotten Tomatoes, right? You look at those ratings. So when you see a film with a 93 critics rating and, say, a 71 or a 68, you know, average person rating, what does that say? Do you draw a particular conclusion from that?
I don't, cause I don't. I actually almost never care about the audience rating. Mm-hmm. To be honest, I look at the critics rating, and also I usually have like based on the made up my mind mm-hmm. about if I want to see it before I looked at Rotten Tomatoes. And on top of that, I usually go directly to the critics I like and mm-hmm. see what they thought of it rather than go to Rotten Tomatoes because I don't care about the consensus. I was like, I know people.
Right.
I have a general feeling of what I'm gonna like based on what the people I know how they feel about things. So I'd rather go to them anyway.
That actually is the smart way to do this, but the way most people don't anymore. But anyway, yeah. What do you?
Yeah, well, I mean, Roger Ebert had to go and die on me, which was a shame because he was the critic who I mean, I thought he was so bright and so interesting and so, but also a populist and also like had a really wonderful lowbrow taste as well. And
based
I always
on the movie he's made.
Sorry,
based on the movie he made, you can.
Yeah, I mean, and so it's true, and I really agreed with him a lot, and. Yeah, I don't use Rotten Tomatoes either. I'm interested that you use Rotten Tomatoes, Colin. I didn't know what it was till about a year ago. I mean,
I look at it.
I still call the film line.
Right.
No, I don't. But
I mean, in the business, there's a lot of problems with this. And what they've started doing is front-loading.
Is gaming
I mean,
the system.
Well,
yeah.
There are some easy critics, right?
Right.
So there are certain critics who are just there because they right. want to go to the screenings and stuff like this. So they get those people early and they do stuff like that.
But
so.
I mean, as to Ben Yagoda's piece where he was saying, look, a lot of critics, I mean, he was pointing to the fact that there's a certain kind of book. So he starts with the novelist Joshua Ferris. Who I do think is an overrated novelist, and some of the people whose opinions I respect think he's a terrific novelist. He doesn't speak to me, and he looks at some of the blurbs that he got or some of the critical responses in reviews that would talk about it as like splendid or perfect or extraordinary. And he was saying, look, Joshua Ferris may be a very very competent guy, but there are very few sublime or splendid or perfect books coming. Let's be honest. This isn't one. Like, let's raise our bar a little bit here and let's reserve words like sublime
let me ask you a question.
Terrific or whatever. And I think you would say the same thing about the Emily Dickinson movie.
Let me ask you a question. As a critic, okay,
yeah.
You get assigned a book to read.
Yeah.
Somebody spent 2.5, 3 years of their life.
Of their life.
Writing this
yes.
book.
Yes,
And you don't like it.
Right.
How willing are you to say,
okay.
Look, this is not a good book. Don't read this book.
Here's what I think the job of a critic is. For me, as a critic writing for general audiences in places that are not highbrow, you know, they're not cineast journals or scholarly journals, but, you know, trying to reach a public. And I think there's two or three things. One, I want to write a piece that's enjoyable to read. Two, I'd like to say something about the art and craft of it for people who are fellow practitioners. But those are both smaller pieces of it than the job of connecting the work to mm-hmm. the people who would enjoy it. Okay, mm-hmm. So I'm not a superhero movie kind of person. I like to think, though, that if I go in to watch a superhero movie, I've thought about the genre enough, done enough research, talked to enough friends, and go into it with an open mind so that for people who like superhero movies, I can say, is this a good one for you?
Mm.
Like, does it succeed or fail on its own terms? And look, there is a community of people who want really airless, boring period dramas about 19th century poets. And the question is this a good airless, boring period drama? I mean,
I want to re-ask my question. How comfortable are you saying this is really not a good book? Oh, I mean, you would say it in a much more lovely and well-crafted way.
I'm pretty comfortable. I've definitely said that about some books. I think sometimes you get the feeling that there's a kind of cynicism to it. Mm-hmm. Like there are certain books you read and you say the author wasn't speaking from something the author wanted to say, but she or he was jumping on a bandwagon. Like someone said, oh, these kind of books are hot. Sometimes you feel there's a cynicism. Like this book isn't even the author trying her or his best. Mm-hmm. I'll also say, though, I'm more comfortable saying that about authors who have a certain degree of success. Mm-hmm. If you're rich or famous, you can take some slings and arrows. Mm-hmm. If you're just starting out and it's your first attempt, like part of my job as a critic is a responsibility to the artistic community and to the world to like support people and to say this there's a way to say this is a really good first attempt, or for a 27-year-old first-time director, this is really an amazing feat.
Although so little of this is written out or spoken out, the kind of latent understandings of criticism. So, Lucy, one of the things that I was saying is, and actually I'm moderating a panel of critics tomorrow at the Goodspeed, and one of the things that I feel that in the theater world these days, particularly the theater world that isn't Broadway, you know, the finances are perilous. The for the nonprofit regional theaters, it's a struggle. And I think critics are less likely to really gouge something. You know, if they don't like something, I could give an example that would really make everybody, okay, I will. Okay, so Adam Gopnik did a musical at the Long Wharf this year, and a lot of people like really, really, really didn't like it. Hardly anybody wrote a pan of it. I mean, there may have been a few.
There were a couple.
Yeah.
There were a couple. Actually, Brian Slattery wrote a great pan of it. And Chris Arnott, who is one of the critics that I do read often. So I see a lot of theater, Colin, mm-hmm. and I think the question that you're asking is not it's an important one to ask, especially are you really going to hold a community theater group that has very perilous finances up next to a different group? But I will say I have no problem going to a show, especially at a place that has a donor base mm-hmm. and is maybe putting on shows because they feel that they're beholden to that donor base, I have no problem taking a show to task. So I would say the last two shows I've seen at Long Wharf Theater were not good. And I wrote reviews that I thought were strong reviews that I spent time on talking about why I did not think these shows succeeded. Am I going to do the same thing for a theater company that is full of hobbyists? No. Probably if I see a show and it really does not hit any of the marks, maybe I won't write about it at all. Or maybe I'll just have a little blip like, hey, this is a cute thing that the theater company is doing. But I think when you're talking about theaters like Long Wharf, like the Yale Rep, and even, I will say, even like the Yale Cabaret, which is a smaller operation but has financial backing behind it mm-hmm. and embraces a permission to fail, you have I think you have an opportunity and a duty as a critic to talk honestly about those works and what is and is not working in those works.
I was laughing just because at Yale Cabaret, they just keep bringing you wine at your table. So by the end, you're
in love with it.
This is true. I will say at Yale Cabaret, I want to give them just the quickest of shout outs on the air because of all of the theater companies that kind of take criticism, they are maybe the only ones in Connecticut that act like grown-ups about it and will process that criticism and then use it in their next performance.
Well, Sean, I want to go back to what you said, which I think is very smart. There's certain critics that you read and you sort of know who they are, you know. And maybe it's not just that, like, I like everything that David Edelstein likes or something, you know, but more like I know who this person is. Because it seems to me part of criticism's job is to start a conversation, not end a conversation. Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, so, you know, Frank Rich hated that play on Broadway and it's closed. It's going to close tomorrow, you know, which is the way things have worked over the years. I'm sensing what you'd like to do is see a conversation start about something that you're interested in.
Well, yeah, I have there's a critic online called Film Crit Hulk. He has this persona that he's the Hulk and he reviews. But he's one of the most profound.
But he's not Drunk Hulk.
No.
That's a different one. Okay.
Yeah, so he's one of the most profound like film scholars I've ever come across, and I go to him because he has the ability to pinpoint things about a particular film that I hadn't even recognized, like what's something that some level of skill that I hadn't even perceived before. Like he's a big fan of the Wachowski Speed Racer. He has like several articles on the the website Birth Movies Death, where he breaks down why that movie was panned by critics and audiences, but is actually like a true work of art. I go to him because I want to see like, okay, if whether I missed out on something when I saw something the first time, or like why something I haven't seen is as good, and like it's beyond just like it was entertaining, but it's like it's doing something on so many levels that I didn't even recognize.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I agree, and I think there's in many cases more skill in finding and understanding something that's maybe been underappreciated than there is in just, you know, beating the crap out of something that maybe is.
Yeah. I should also say that. You know, it's not as if – I mean, some of the most profound theater experiences I've had have been low-budget amateur or undergraduate or high school productions, right? I mean, mm-hmm. a really good critic – and this is actually one of Yagoda's good points, right, is that he says a lot of times professional critics spend way too much time on the things that matter to them as critics who see so much bad work. Mm-hmm. So if they see really interesting camera angles, like they all just – they light up, even though most people don't care about camera angles, right? I would take that point even further and say like – There are a lot of things that the average consumer of culture cares about that that are perfectly within the reach of amateurs, that aren't the that you don't need exquisite equipment for, or that you don't even need a lot of training for. Really good comic timing can pop up anywhere.
Absolutely.
Really good connection to the audience can pop up. I mean, the best production of Angels in America I ever saw was an undergraduate production mm-hmm. with basically no set, but like there was so much heart in it, and I walked out sobbing. And was it uneven? Sure. Was every actor in it great? No, but a few of them were, and you know, theater's mystical. Like it's not always about pulling together the most talented people and paying them, you know, the top dollar.
So there's right, no formula.
Yeah. Right. That's right.
We probably need to switch topics here just so we get to everything. So the next topic is one where I can actually just read you the headline and we're done, right? The headline is the whole story. The headline is IKEA wants you to pee on this ad. If you're pregnant, it will give you a discount on a crib. That's basically the entire story, although you have to know that it takes place in Sweden. Is there anything else you need to know? I don't think so. So anyway, the ad is on some kind of treated paper that is the equivalent of a pregnancy test. What are you laughing at?
Just, you know, as someone who's lived
through... What are you laughing at, father of many daughters?
As someone who's lived through a lot of pregnancy tests or been in...
Well, how much do they cost? Do they cost a lot of money?
Yeah, they're $20 or $30, I think.
$20 or $30.
I think. I don't know.
Well, you've gone through a lot of money.
They're usually bought with a lot of other groceries. I mean, it's not like you try to bury them.
You just get one every week at this point.
You try to bury them underneath the Cottonelle.
You're
underneath.
Like, we have milk. Do we need a pregnancy test? Can we do it? Eggs.
Do you want me to weigh in first on that? I mean,
I don't care. Yeah.
Go ahead. I mean, that's weird. I'll just say that's weird. Sweden's weird. Scandinavia's weird. They have good parental leave, but they're different over there. And
so you don't think this would ever happen in this country?
No, anything will happen in this country. Capitalism dissolves all morals and decorum. Of course, it'll happen. But I'm all for it. Like, why not? I mean, let me say this. I actually just thought of something interesting to say. Because I was really just thunderstruck by the whole idea, and I thought I had nothing to add, but. It's nice that they're treating fertility as a positive. They're basically saying, hey, take this pregnancy test. If you're pregnant, what, they give you a discount on a crib?
Well, yeah, that's Sean. They're treating it as a positive because they want to sell you a crib.
Yeah, yeah,
right?
But they're not treating it as a disaster. And that's a really interesting thing. And you'll see this in ads for pregnancy, for home pregnancy tests, which is some of them treat it as a scary, like the look on their face when they see the blue plus or whatever is like, sometimes it's terror. So they don't know how to sell it. So it's been marketed in different ways. Sometimes it's terror. Sometimes it's like nervous but kind of tingly anticipation, and sometimes it's real joy. And I'm glad they went all in to say that, you know, that this is great. Now, it's not, pregnancy's not always a happy thing for people, but I think more often than not it is.
Well, the pregnancy could be a positive, but then when you like come to your senses, well, you just peed on a piece of paper for a discount on a crib, like
you have no dignity left.
Yeah, that's what's fascinating about it to me is that like. How great is this discount? Like that you like? Why are we peeing on paper?
Right. There's a term in the world of kind of animal behavior, submissive urination. Right. you have submissively urinated to IKEA because you want to see if you're eligible.
I think it's just a capitalistic like let's see how much we can get people to demean themselves for like.
Do you then have to bring in the piece of paper that's been urinated on your smelly urine drenched piece of paper and say 5% off the
key?
Well, if you're a good person, you'll laminate it.
You know what I want them to do?
What otherwise would be the point?
I don't. don't even want the discount. I want them to come and assemble it for me. I mean, I want to, you know what I want from
IKEA?
Yeah,
that's the value.
I don't want the discount from IKEA. I want them to assemble it.
Right. Well, we actually, Sean and I were talking about the logistics of this, right? Because, so first of all, like, okay, whatever. You pee on this, you get a free pregnancy test. But if you think that you may be pregnant unexpectedly or joyfully, you are probably buying more than one pregnancy test. You're going to buy, like, I don't know, 2 or 3 or 4 or 5, just to make sure that you are or are not pregnant, right? So that's one of those things. I also don't know that I would trust an IKEA crib to have, like, a tiny person, like a tiny human, my tiny human in an IKEA crib. But then also the logistics of peeing on a newspaper versus peeing on a stick, I think would really be hard. Like peeing on a stick is fairly straightforward.
It's toilet friendly.
Yeah.
It's toilet friendly.
Although people say that it's hard to aim at the little stick sometimes.
Well, I guess that's what the value of the paper is, that it's just like, you don't really have to hit it.
Right, exactly.
No, there's no bullseye. Yeah.
Well, but at the same time, we were like, what do you do? Like, do you pee in a cup and then pour the pee from the cup onto the paper? Do you pee on the hole?
Where's the fun in that? I feel like it's sort of like Twister, you know? It's your feet in the right
position.
This
is one of those days I wish you still took phone calls during the nose, Colin. I feel like somebody out there was recently back from Stockholm.
Right.
And you, like, somewhere we would get some answers.
And, like, peed on a piece of paper.
Absolutely.
Look, first of all, we're borrowing Yale University studio. We could get kicked out of here for this in any second. We're supposed to be talking about Russian economics or something here.
This is the home of the Milgram experiments. Nothing gets you
right.
kicked out.
Right. We lied to them about what the show is about. Well, did anybody have – maybe I've just become very paranoid living here in America. So, Sean, I'll ask you this question. Like, I was sort of thinking, well, if I have to bring the newspaper in or the paper in that I've – if I'm a woman I've peed on, I just feel like I'm handing data over to them. Like, I wouldn't want to, like, you know – this is like now they can collect stuff about me. This is the beginning of IKEA having my DNA or whatever it wants on file.
I mean, that's just par for the course. You know what I mean? Everyone's data mining. I mean, at least they're kind of like a little bit more straight. I just love the person who's just like strolling into IKEA and just slamming. Like, I mean, like they came just, they didn't even, like, it hasn't been a few days. They come directly, the paper's still soggy, and they just slam it down. It's like, this crib is $20 less. Like, it's, I don't understand.
Sean's right. It's par for the course, Colin. I'll tell you, there, within 5 seconds after you and your partner have discovered there is a child coming, your Facebook feed is sending you to Kids R Us. Like,
right.
it is uncanny. I mean, they are paying off nurses. There are black helicopters swooping into Planned Parenthood. There is no way you can keep the knowledge out of the hands of Big Toy.
Well, that's one. But then they'll also know I'm a mutant with special powers, though, if they have my urine.
Right.
Well,
that's my point. Anyway, I agree with Sean that this is something that some marketing company thought up, but the clerks never signed off on this. The poor people who are going to be receiving the soggy paper.
Because who's like flipping through a magazine? Like, oh, I guess I'll just see if I'm pregnant. You know what I mean? Like, it's a decision. You know what I mean? Like, you've been thinking about this for a while.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, according to Lucy, you've already bought 5 pregnancies.
Well, no, but I mean, I did think it was an interesting thing because I was kind of speaking in disparaging terms about it because I am at a point in my life where I do not see. I think fertility is great for other people.
Right.
But for myself, that's like not really something I'm interested in right now. But I was talking to my partner and he thought, this is great. Mark, he totally agreed with you. He was like, this is great that they are treating it as a plus. And advertising to women like, oh, you have kids, it's not the end, or you're having a kid, it's not the end of the world, and that they're treating parenthood as something maybe to aspire to.
Have you thought that Tom was trying to tell you something?
Oh, I mean, we can talk about that. Well,
again,
the parenthood
I don't think
train is a different discussion.
People should just go out and get the magazine, like just buy like 20 of the magazine. Though. That's probably cheaper,
it's
right?
It's a Swedish magazine.
Right.
It's probably like way cheaper to just buy the magazine and have that as your pregnancy
but,
test. You know what I mean?
But it's also a ladies magazine, right?
Yeah. One would assume so.
But I think that was in the article. Like, it's marketed toward women.
I do think that it's damning with faint praise to say, oh, you're having a child. It's not the end of the world. However, this is the end of the segment.
I'm pretty sure it's not MMA today.
It's wooden boat.
Right. All right. So we have to take a little break here. We want to leave plenty of room for Mr. Chappelle. So we'll do that, and we shall be back.
I'm going to be on you. Pee on you. Yes, I do. Yes, I do. I'll pee on you. I'll pee on you.
Sometimes the funniest thing to say is mean. You know what I mean? It's a tough position to be in. So I say a lot of mean things. But you guys got to remember, I'm not saying it to be mean. I'm saying it because it's funny. And everything's funny till it happens to you. But you know why I be thinking sometimes I want to stop doing comedy? And you know, I don't want to sound like a braggart saying this, but the real, like, reason I want to stop is because I'm too goddamn good at it. I'm dope, nigga. Like, no, I'm not even exaggerating. It's not exciting. Every night before I come out on stage, I'll be backstage like, I'm sure this is gonna go well. And it always does. Everybody gets mad because I say these jokes. But you understand that this is the best time to say them. More now than ever. And I know there's some comedians in the back. You have a responsibility to speak recklessly. Otherwise, my kids may never know what reckless talk sounds like. The joys of being wrong. I didn't come here to be right. Just came here to fuck around. As a policy, you gotta understand, I never feel bad about anything I say up here. And I would never admit this to you if I hadn't locked your phones up.
All right, so this is from two different Dave Chappelle specials. They were both released simultaneously on Netflix at the beginning of the year. One of them is called Equanimity. The other one is called The Bird Revelation. They are, in fact, part more of a quartet because there were two other comedy specials released earlier, last year, which is a lot. It's a lot of comedy specials. So I think the stand-up comedian gets to go first here. And so, I don't know, Sean... I won't even ask you a specific question. I'll just let you go where you want to go.
Okay, so I feel like I'm going to get kicked out of the comedy community for saying what I'm about to say. But first of all, I think Dave Chappelle didn't need to put out four specials last year. He should have put out – he could have combined the content of those four specials into probably 1.5 specials. Mm. And so the problem I think with Dave Chappelle, there's a lot of backlash to the things he's saying. He's like – you know, comedians have a responsibility to speak recklessly. And it's like, they don't. They really don't. There's some part of that. But it's also like a guy like Brian Regan is one of he's a huge stand-up. He's well-respected. Brian Regan doesn't speak recklessly. He's just funny. I think the responsibility of a comedian is to be funny. And Chappelle's super funny. I don't think his recent specials are an example of him at his best, though. I think he starts the special Equanimity and he says like I'm really good at comedy and I'm too good. And it's like the rest of the special, like there's a couple of jokes and you're like, I've heard of micers do these jokes. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And it's like, but I watch a lot of comedy. You know what I mean? Just as an interest and also as a stand up in like comedy rooms. But so I feel like a lot of it. It's not all great.
Right. I don't know as much about Dave Chappelle as I probably should or could, but doing a little bit of reading even for this, it seems as though he has also kind of a reputation for maybe showing up at a comedy club and talking for 2 hours.
He set the record for the longest comedy. He's done like 9 hours in a row. Yeah. Like, no, legitimately nine hours, just straight.
And wow. In those sessions, a lot of times, he will be feeling around as opposed to having any kind of tight set worked out. He'll be sort of feeling around for meaning in places. Well,
and
where he
you
wants
see
to
a lot of that in the specials he released, where he put out four specials, but for most of them, I think the idea that he has of himself of like I'm so good at comedy, he's going out with. I don't think he worked those bits to the perfection when he went out on stage. He went out and he's just riffing. And Chappelle is so good. I mean, he is that good that he's able to just go out on his special and basically doing something that's relatively a new joke to him.
How is this different from the fact that real connoisseurs of certain bands, they want the basement tapes of Dylan, or they want, you know, all the backlogs of the live shows of the Dead released, even though everyone knows for every 3 hours there's only one song that would make it to a greatest hits compilation?
No, like, I think I would argue this is different.
Okay.
I would argue that it's different in the sense that what you're seeing here is, I mean, if you're going to enjoy these specials, and I did enjoy them, but I
laughed like crazy.
Yeah, I didn't have a well worked out understanding of Chappelle or that I could really contrast this work with previous work the way Sean can. But I thought some of the excitement, Lucy, was watching him try things try things that he wasn't quite sure about, try ways of getting at something that he wasn't quite sure about. I would contrast that to the like the Basement Tapes or something.
No, but I think it's some of the same thing. It's not the tight that there's virtue in seeing them when it's not the tight 10 minutes.
Except that those aren't in front of an audience. These are in front of an audience where if in fact he doesn't get it right,
he has to take my live show example, which aren't in front of an audience.
Okay, but see, Chappelle is brilliant. He's a really brilliant guy. And when he goes up on stage, he has an idea of himself as a profound thinker in a lot of respects, especially on his show, the Chappelle Show, and like his older special, like Killing Him Softly. He was a profound thinker. I think in a lot of when you go on stage with these newer specials, a lot of the ideas aren't fully worked out. But to come up as like he sees himself as like a philosopher of comedy, and you go up on stage, and the idea is not actually like you haven't solidified what your stance is, like, I want to come see you when you have it done. Like, what's the final thought? The idea that you're like, I don't know if this is right or wrong, but I'm going to just say it. And it's like, I'd rather you just have a firm, funny joke than like a kind of, he spends enough time on stage riffing through stuff when he's not doing a special that he should be able to have a fully formed idea by the time he's done a special.
All right. I want to get Lucy into this conversation, but before I do that, I've been reminded that I haven't reminded anybody what we're doing or who we are.
What are we doing?
We're doing the notes. We're down in the beautiful Yale studios here in New Haven. With me is Lucy Gelman, editor of the Arts Paper, host of WNHH Radio's Kitchen Sink, Sean Murray, stand-up comedian, writer, host of Fantasy Film Ball podcast, and Mark Oppenheimer, editor-at-large for Tablet Magazine, host of podcast Unorthodox, and he's published 3 or 4 things like this morning. So he's the hardest working man in American journalism.
But I'm off Twitter, so that ups my productivity. Yeah.
All right. So
I'm picking up the slack.
Lucy, one thing that we haven't really talked about so far is this is also Chappelle wading out into the waters of the current moment. Particularly in the second of the two specials, he really tries to formulate some ideas or some comic takes or some not so comic takes on the Me Too movement. But he's stirring up all kinds of trouble in these two specials. How did you evaluate how he did it?
Yeah, I think I would agree with Sean in that for me, one of the interesting parts about this is I actually kind of like seeing process. I like watching process. And so for me, it was like, huh, this is interesting. I'm not super well-versed in Dave Chappelle and his shtick. But I think for me watching, it was like, oh, is this going to work? Is this not going to work? I actually thought some of the bits that he did about male privilege, even when he was in the first special, kind of doing this weird walk backwards about some of the content that he has done on the trans community. And I do find some of his work transphobic in a really problematic way. But even some of the stuff he was doing when he said, like I know someone's committed when they're going to cut their member off, because that is and the unspoken bit is that's what male privilege looks like. I was like, that was maybe not gracefully executed, but that was funny. Mm-hmm. That was funny. Like I maybe want to see more of that. I think whenever you have someone wading out into the waters of Me Too, it's something that I, as a woman who thinks about sexual assault and harassment, who certainly thinks about it in the media world, but the world more broadly and professionally, I want to see how it's going to work. I will say there were points when I found listening. I went back last night and I kind of speed watched both after watching them an initial time. And I found it a little bit arduous to think like, oh, am I going to have to sit through this whole thing, which is hence the speed watching. But I think definitely if you're someone who's interested in process, these are worth seeing.
Let me just say a couple of things just for the viewers, listeners, whatever they're called, readers, which is that the two specials are somewhat different. Equanimity is played in a large hall in Washington, D.C. It does reflect, I think, some work that he had been doing and turning over and tuning a little bit over a series of concert performances. It is, I think, by far the tighter of the two. The second of the two, the Bird Revelation, is done in a much smaller venue. He is inches away from the closest members of his audience, his stuff is not as well worked out there. And he really is, I mean, he's doing process, as Lucy would say. I mean, in a way, these things, and he's on a stool, he's vaping in the first one, he's smoking in the second right. one. That seems significant somehow, I don't know why.
I mean, I do think if we want to talk specifically about wading into the waters of Me Too and trying to feel it out, I do think he sort of hits these notes of like, this is what male privilege looks like in a way that's interesting. And as someone who I was listening to.
Do you mean he's critiquing it or he's unknowingly performing someone who doesn't know his own privilege?
No, I think he's like hitting a note about it. I don't know if I'd go as.
You mean he's commenting on it?
Yeah. Okay. I don't know that I'd go so far as to call it critique.
Okay.
But as someone who. So yesterday I was listening to a podcast in which the host asked about the Me Too movement in regards to film. And one of the guests actually said some stuff in which there was there was kind of some unknowing women shaming that maybe he didn't recognize was women shaming. And I thought, wow, I would rather go back and listen to Chappelle try to figure this thing out than listen to someone who maybe thinks they're saying something that's okay that's really not okay.
Well, Sean, one of the other things that he's really doing here, I mean, we know that there are other comedians like Jerry Seinfeld and Chris Rock who have announced that they won't play college campuses anymore because there are too many forbidden topics. Mm. People have lost their sense of humor. There's just so many things that are third rails you can't talk about. They don't enjoy talking to that kind of audience. This is something that runs through both of these specials. I think maybe the first one a little bit more than the second one is that whole question of, you know, are you going to tell me that there's a whole bunch of stuff that I can't talk about because I, Dave Chappelle, have some questions about whether you can do that or not. I mean, just react to that, I guess.
So I think there's a tremendous value in not giving in to, I don't want to go so far as to say censorship, but I guess it is censorship. I'm saying, like, you're not allowed to talk about this thing. And even, like him addressing, like, some of the trans issues and the Me Too movement, I think he's allowed to have an unsure opinion on it. But I think I'm a comic, I'm on the side of comedians generally, but I think also it's not that no one's saying you can't talk about it. It's saying that if you talk about this and it's not in, like, it's, you're wrong, people are allowed to say you're wrong. Mm-hmm. Like, no one's saying he cannot talk about trans people. I've seen a lot of people on Twitter like having arguments about it. And he's like, I'm not like there's a music writer Craig Jenkins from Vulture, and he talks about how he said, no one's saying Chappelle can't talk about being trans or his experience with trans people, but it's like, if you're wrong about trans people or whoever else is allowed to say, man, that's not necessarily the right opinion. You know what I mean? So you don't have to want to be in a room where people are saying, like, you can't say that. But people are allowed to say you can't say. Like, when you say, like, when he says comedians have the responsibility to be reckless, it's like, yeah, but people, like, you're reckless. You know what I mean? It's like, it's against the grain. So you're going to have to face that backlash when you do that.
I completely agree. And let me say something from the start, which is, as a writer, I never have bought the romantic defense of artists. Like, I don't think that because I'm a writer, I get to say ridiculous things or mistreat my family or get hooked on heroin or forget to pay my taxes. Like,
I mean, you've done all those things. Those are personal
I've done those
choices.
Things because yeah. because
that's
I'm,
separate from the art.
Yeah, I've done those things because I'm a reprobate and a fall and because of the fall from grace in the garden. But I don't think that being an artist is an excuse. And I think that artists can have, you know, frankly, bourgeois conventional habits, which include treating people well and tipping 20% and whatever. So I don't buy the sort of be reckless because that's, you know, that's my job. Never bought that. Now, that said, I do think that when you look at the art form of comedy, and this is going back, you know, when he's smoking, I'm absolutely thinking he's smoking because Lenny Bruce smoked on stage. I mean, there's a tradition of certain people who go up, and rather than do a tight set of joke, rather than do the Neil Simon or the Seinfeld, they're doing the Mort Saul or the Lenny Bruce or, frankly, the Louis C.K., which often could be much more discursive, much more storytelling. I mean, Tig Notaro works in that vein where, like, mm-hmm. you often are hearing a long story and you don't know where it's going. And then at the end, there's a chuckle that grows into a big grin that mm-hmm. grows into a glow, but there was never a big guffaw. So I think he's working a bit more in that vein. Do I think that out of these 4 hours there was a tight 90 minutes? Yes. But I want to say one final thing, which is a lot of it also is you have to look at not the 1 minute slice, but the 90 minute or the 4 hours. So you have to look at it as a show. In one of his two earlier specials from last year, I think, when did the first two drop?
About April.
Yeah. he has a bit about Jews, you know, and one of it is like, you can't win a complaint contest with Jews, right? Was that how it went? It was like, they'll always Holocaust you. They'll always be, well, you know, how, you know, let's try 6 million on for size or whatever. I mean, it was something about, and it was brief, but it was like, you know, like, I don't know. I mean, I could have, one could be up in arms about that, but here's the thing. I don't for a second think that he has a beef with Jews. I think he was mining some humor from a particular thing that we all kind of knew what he was talking about. I'm not sure that for a moment I think he's anti-trans, and I don't think he's homophobic. I mean, I think if you look at the context of his work over time, I see him as a force for progressivism, and I look at the hour-long special or the 4 hours or the career when I judge the joke here and there. It doesn't mean I would have made all his jokes, and I think some of them are failures. But I think that's how the spirit in which I encounter
him. I think he's much more phobic or hostile towards people who are telling him he can't do this material.
Absolutely.
And he does ultimately do a Caitlyn Jenner joke that, as far as I'm concerned, is like, all right, you want to hear the joke?
Right.
A transphobic joke that's really going to bother you? He goes, well, yeah. Here it is.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of that. Lucy, we're running out of time here, but, you know, just to sort of connect to the piece that we read, the Yogoda piece we read about critics, the reviews of this have been pretty tough, particularly from critics like Jason Zinnemann, who's now sort of the, you know, the Ben Brantley of comedy now for the New York Times, and Matt Zoller Seitz. And they've sort of complained that they've, you know, he goes too far, or he crosses too many lines, or there's something too transgressive about all this, you know, and they cite some of these, you know, very tough to listen to jokes. I don't know. What did you make of that? What do you make of that?
I don't know. I certainly would say, if you are a listener that is coming into this with sensitive ears, this is probably not for you. But I would also say most of Dave Chappelle's like that ship sailed a while ago. Yeah, I mean, I still think he's trying to figure something out. I think at the end of the first special, there's a bit about citizenship and Emmett Till. And I watched it and I thought, wow, that really didn't work. And I'm not totally sure what he was trying to do. But it was really, like, I so was not expecting it. It, you know, it caught me by surprise.
Right. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, okay, so I think ultimately for me, it's all about how funny is it. Like, if that Caitlyn, I don't think the Caitlyn Jenner joke was a profound, like, breakdown. People, I've heard that kind of joke a million times before. So it's like, if it was, like, the funniest, like, okay, one of my favorite comedians ever is Patrice O'Neill. Mm. Patrice O'Neill's views on women, I don't agree with most of them at all. But he's so funny, and he's pointing out kind of the hypocrisy of, like, how we think about certain things. I was like, okay, I don't have to agree with that. I think it's funny. I don't agree with the Caitlyn Jenner. I mean, I just don't think the Caitlyn Jenner joke's that funny. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a value, like Lucy was saying before, like, and Mark, you were talking about, like, process, like, seeing process. But I go to a comedy club to see the process because, the reason comedians tour is so they can get their hour tight, and by the time they're on Netflix, it's perfect,
yeah.
Or as close to perfect as it's going to get. Like, in The Age of Spin, one of his earlier specials, he does this super long bit about Cosby, and he's like, you don't know where it's going, and at the end, the joke is so funny. And it's like, he tries to do the same thing with the Emmett Till thing. He does the callback to the first joke,
yeah.
And it just doesn't work as well.
Right.
So I just think if it was just, it was purely funnier, it wouldn't even, the backlash wouldn't be there.
All right, we got to go to a break here, so we'll have time to recommend some things to you. That's what we're going to do after this.
Thanks to all the people at Yale Studios for making this work, and thanks to Skull and Bones for giving us the nuclear launch codes. That was very generous. Today's show is produced by Jonathan McPants and me, Kyon Wolf. Amanda Fish will urinate on any advertisement for $99.95. The part of Bill Curry was played by Dick Gregory. On Monday, we bring back a show about being black in America. On Tuesday, we look at another persecuted group, redheaded people. Don't call them the G word. And now, back to Colin.
All right, now it is time to recommend some things. Oppie, why don't you go first?
Oh, I have one I'm so excited to recommend.
Okay.
Now, Colin, I never tell you anything you don't know with culture, because you do this for more of a living than I do. You know, at one point I recommended Walter Tevis, and you're like, I've read 7 Walter Tevis novels, and I thought I discovered this.
That was just that one time.
Right. But do you know Roger Deakin?
No.
Does that ring a bell? Okay. I was in England Do I have 90 seconds?
Yeah, like you have 90 seconds.
I have 90 seconds.
We're a little tight here.
Okay, I was in England at a conference a couple weeks ago, and I went to one of the Waterstones Books, which is one of their big chains. And it's interesting because the Venn diagrams of what they read and what we read are overlapping, but not – there's stuff that is huge there. They always have a big nature section because the English love to walk and swim. I'm at a table and I see a book called Waterlog by a guy named Roger Deakin, who's a naturalist who decided to swim the country, basically to swim the fens and the moors and the ponds, a lot of which had been privatized during the Thatcher era and were illegal. You weren't supposed to jump in them. And I just read a page and loved it, bought the book, read it. It's about his spending a year swimming in forbidden places in England. And it is the most magical, transporting thing. He also has a moat around his own house. And I came home and I said to Sid, I want a moat. Like some people want a dog or a fancy car or this. I want a moat. So Waterlog by Roger Deakin.
You can't have a moat in West.
I want a moat.
Yeah, you can't have one. All right, Sean, what have you got for us?
I just finished reading The Paper Menagerie by Ken Liu, who's an amazing sci-fi short story writer and novelist. It's this amazing book of short stories where he has the same thing with another great author, Ted Chiang, who wrote the story that became Arrival. They can blend these like super high concepts, like brilliant, so far past my intelligence level, like sci-fi concepts with like these really heartbreaking and like human stories. And I think like he tells every type. So he tells stories that take place in the 17th century and he tells stories that take place on planets we've never discovered yet. Like 5 centuries in the future, and they both resonate with me the same way. I think he's an amazing author. So The Paper Menagerie is a book I would recommend.
All right. Lucy, what do you got?
I have two really quick ones. The first is a podcast by Nose Regular, actually, Mercy Quay. She's doing a new podcast called Work, W-E-R-K, It Out. And this month especially, it's good all the time, but this month especially, she's looking at failure and the idea of failure. And she's interviewing people who have really flopped at something or feel like they have. And it is moving and funny and wonderful to hear the people she talks to. So I highly recommend that. It's on WNHH, but also you can find it on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. The other is a new New Haven business called Jake's Mom's Cookies. It's run by this woman who...
Jake's mom,
Laura Hurwitz, who kind of decided to completely rebuild her career in her 60s. She's really cool. Her latest undertaking is support other women bakers. And so she pairs up with other women bakers from around the region to bring people things like nut-free cookies, gluten-free cookies, vegan cookies. It sounds silly. She is one of the coolest people I know. And I highly recommend going out, you know, get a cookie, treat yourself. It's Friday, but also learn more about Laura because she's very cool. So they sell them at Coffee and Cafe Romeo. You can also, shameless plug, go to the arts paper and read about her. Mm-hmm. But she is really interesting, and the website is easy to remember. It's just jakesmomscookies.com.
But you cannot urinate on the arts paper.
You can, or on the cookies.
Or on the cookies.
You didn't hear the first 15 minutes.
Once you've bought the cookie, you can do what you want with it. Let's be honest. All right, so we were going to recommend this last week, Jacques Lamar and I, so I'll recommend it now. And it's easy to find. Sarah Silverman, since we're talking about comedians, had this rather unusual encounter with a horrible troll who called her the absolute worst name, and she just turned it around and turned it into something else. I think that's all I'm going to say. If you just Google Sarah Silverman troll, you'll probably get to this pretty quickly. It turns into a long exchange on Twitter. It's remarkable. And if more things like that happened, probably the world would become a somewhat better place.
Her sister is one of the great reform rabbis.
Really?
Sarah Silverman's sister.
Oh. Mm-hmm. Among podcasts, I'm so late to this party that it's ridiculous. But The Daily, which is the New York Times, Michael Barbaro hosts this.
Of New Haven.
Of New Haven.
Wow. Michael Barbaro grew up here.
It is just terrific. It really is just like if you have a podcast feed and you don't have The Daily in it, you're cheating yourself. And it's relatively short. It takes usually some piece of the news and just analyzes it so well. It's kind of hyper-produced. It's not like a raw-sounding thing. Anyway, really, really good. The last thing I would say is read something or listen to something or watch something about Watergate. Watergate has so much to teach us about the present moment. If you can't think of anything else and you've got a Roku box, just box or something like that or a stick, just in search, Dick Cavett's Watergate. I think Amazon Prime has this. Just a little documentary about Watergate and Cavett's role in it. Or read Michael Schutzen's great book. Or listen to Slow Burn, which is a terrific podcast. It's a new podcast.
Amazon Prime.
Prime.
La prime.
All right. Thanks very much to Lucy Gelman and Sean Murray and Mark Oppenheimer. And thanks to everybody here in New Haven. So nice to us at the Yale Studios. We'll be back on Tuesday with a live show.
I would have said that one. Avon, Farmington. Yeah.